It's about 7:30, a little after. So welcome you to the Dallas Philosopher Forum. I'm David Alcheck, and are you guys ready? Ladies and gentlemen? Let's see. I'm going to ask, are any newcomers tonight, anybody who hasn't been here for the first time? Yes. Where'd you hear about it?
Just through the meetup.
For meetup?
Yeah.
Good. And these people that I've been, how did you hear about us? From meetup?
No. Friends told us that we came.
Oh, okay. Good.
And we're always from who? Sitting up.
From where?
From Minneapolis.
Minneapolis. Great. Okay, well, welcome. And, the Dallas Philosophers Forum has been in existence for 30, 35 years.
Microphone.
Hello.
30 or 35 years. And we have wonderful speakers that many subjects. Tonight we're going to talk about scientific research and its ethics. Make sure that you pay your entry fee or whatever, $5 to this gentleman over here raising his hand.
Yeah, there we go.
And take care of your bill, please, before you go,
mm-hmm.
or as you go, and take care of your server. El Phoenix has been very, very nice and generous to let us use this room. We're kind of grandfathered into it. They're not allowing any other organization to use it. But we've been here for several years, and we really enjoy it. Tonight, we're privileged to have Dr. Frederick Rennell from UT Southwestern. He's been a speaker here several times. Dr. Rennell was born in Philadelphia and reared there, and went to an undergraduate degree in chemistry from Clark University, and PhD in biochemistry from Tufts in 1970. And after graduating there, and he came to Dallas for his postdoc work. Can you hear me? At UT Southwestern, where he joined the faculty there in 72. He's known internationally for his research on cell biology and of wound healing and tissue mechanics. His interdisciplinary work has been in bioethics in the field as a boundary between science and philosophy, which is what we really need. I wrote that in my book. With the goal to advance science education and public understanding of science. In 1998, he founded and was the first director of the UT Southwestern Ethics in Science and Medicine Program. And in 2004, organized the North Texas Bioethics Network. He's author of 150 scientific papers and a couple of books. The last one published in 2009, Everyday Practice of Science, Where Intuition and Passion Meet Objectivity and Logic. Let's see. In 2012, he received the UT Regents Outstanding Teaching Award, and in 2017, he received the State of Medicine Minnie Stevens Piper Professor Award. So we are privileged to have Dr. Grinnell with us. Welcome him again to Dallas Philosophers Forum.
Is this turned on?
Yes, turned on radio.
Yeah, you can hear me? You probably can't even hear me without it. Thank you, Dave.
All right. Thank you, Fred.
This works? Yes. All right. So I'm happy to be here and discuss with you this topic tonight about research integrity and ambiguity.
And what am I?
You're blocking the screen.
No. All right, I'm imprinted. So as I talk, please feel free to raise questions, interrupt. You know, this is not meant. I mean, it potentially is a dialogue, and so that's the way I like to think. So I thought first I'd tell you how I got involved in this. There's some numbers, and it shows you that. I know this is.
Push forward.
How do I remind me how I make the?
I think if you just push it.
Push here. Oh, there we go. Okay. So back in the mid-1970s, all of a sudden, there were a number of public disclosures of misconduct in science. And the result with that was that there were a whole bunch of articles written, what's going on with science? What's wrong with science? And these were not trivial things. These were cases of fabrication, lying. Let me just get this out of the way. Reporting experiments that were never carried out, and plagiarism, stealing, taking data from other people. And in 1988, the National Institutes of Health said, from now on, students have to receive training in research ethics. And nobody had ever done anything like that in the university. However, I had been teaching, starting in the 1970s, of course, in the readings in the philosophy of science. So the dean at the medical school came to me and said, would you be willing to take your course that was a lot of fun, actually, that you teach for a relatively small number of kids over a semester and turn it into a research integrity course so we could fulfill this meeting. So that's how I started back then, being interested in and teaching about research integrity. Okay, so there's a kind of an enigma that exists about the research integrity out there in the field. There's an organization, a federal organization called the Office of Research Integrity. It started out in 1989 as the Office of Scientific Integrity in NIH, and then it became ORI in the Health and Human Services in 1993. And its job is to oversee research integrity issues. It helps train RIOs. Every institution now has a research integrity officer. They get the boot camp, handbooks, videos. It has all kinds of programs, intramural, extramural research. It's a big deal, okay? And maybe it should be that, because if you do analyses and you ask researchers, have you ever committed misconduct? You find out that about 2% say, yes, I've done research misconduct, and another 14% say, my colleagues have, I know about it, okay? But the weird thing about this is that there are 250,000 scientists just supported by NIH, okay? That's just NIH, not all of HHS. The number of research misconduct findings per year, going back to 1995, is 20 or 25. 275 total cases of misconduct over that whole entire period. So that's why I say it's an enigma. It's really weird because there's so there's so many people doing science. A lot of people say they've committed misconduct. There's this whole organization to look after it, and there are hardly any cases of misconduct. And now, more recently, there's a new trend. And that is, there are people who say, well, everything being done is wrong. Okay? Why most published research findings are false. And NIH plans to enhance reproducibility. Francis Collins is the director of NIH, and Tabak is an associate director. Or in the New York Times, retracted scientific studies, a growing list. Okay? So here's some data. So it's true that the number of retracted studies in science have gone up dramatically since 1977 to now. Here we are, 2007, 2001. Well, if you read across here, there are probably total about 1,000 studies retracted. During that time period, there were 4 million studies published. So it's the same thing. So that's why I say there's an enigma. I don't understand the exactly what's going on in trying to analyze the level of research integrity, at least the looking at numbers. But here's something I do understand, and that is that science is very ambiguous. And I'm going to tell you why I think that should be. So here, this gets back now to 1989, when I first got involved in that, and NIH came up with a definition. What's scientific misconduct? Fabrication, making up data. Falsification, changing your data to fit your hypothesis. Plagiarism, stealing somebody else's data. Or other practices that seriously deviate from those that are commonly accepted within the scientific community for proposing, conducting, or reporting research. Well, when that definition came out, a lot of people in the scientific community sort of went nuts. This part, other practices.
Yeah.
Okay? And one of them was a man named Howard Schachman, who became one of my mentors, who wrote in 1970 when he testified to Congress, "It is our view that this language is vague and its inclusion could discourage unorthodox, novel, or highly innovative approaches. It hardly needs pointing out that brilliant, creative, pioneering research deviates from that commonly accepted within the scientific community." So I got very interested, because of my interest in philosophy, in this, and I began to think about the idea that there were a lot of things in science that were ambiguous. And so I wrote this editorial in Science, Ambiguity in the Practice of Science, and that began this theme that I'm talking about tonight. And when a few years later, the federal government actually reached a consensus on what should be the definition of scientific misconduct, it was limited to fabrication, falsification, or plagiarism. That other practices disappeared. It wasn't there. But then this definition went on in an interesting way, and it said a finding of research misconduct requires that there be a significant departure from accepted practices of the relevant research community. So the implication of that is different communities have different research practices, and you really need to understand the community and the practices if you want to understand what counts as scientific misconduct. So the talk that I'm giving you now, or a lot of it, is in an article called Research Integrity in Everyday Practice of Science that I published a few years ago. And the basic premise of that article is that ethical challenges inevitably arise in practice of science because of these ambiguities. And if you don't understand the ambiguities in this practice, then when these problems arise, you won't know how to deal with them. Okay, so that's sort of my point. And let me just give you an example, one of my favorite examples of what I mean. So there now have been 4 or 5 real conferences on research integrity. Okay, and this is the Singapore conference in 2010. At that conference, the Singapore principles were enunciated. Honesty in all aspects of research, accountability, professional courtesy, good stewardship. It all sounds so reasonable. So let's just think of this one. Honesty in all aspects of research. This is Sir Peter Medawar, one of the very famous scientists of the 20th century. Got the Nobel Prize for discovering transplantation immunology. He's the one whose original work made possible everything that we do now when we do transplants. He started that. And in 1963, he wrote an essay called, "Is the Scientific Paper a Fraud?" And the answer was yes. So how's it possible to say honesty in all aspects of research and then say, but the scientific paper is a fraud? So by the end of tonight, I hope that you will understand the answer to that question. That's part of my goal. but I'm not going to answer it just yet. But I will tell you that what I want to do is leave the conventional notion of science as a linear model, even though it's showed here as a circle, that suggests that hypothesis to discovery, that path follows a direct line, that facts are waiting to be observed and collected, that researchers are objective and dispassionate, and scientific education takes all of these things together, and we end up with the scientific method. And what I want to talk about is instead the everyday practice of science. And if you want to learn about that, the place you have to learn about it is reading the memoirs of scientists. So this is like a fantastic book, The Double Helix, Jim Watson's description of the discovery of the structure of DNA. If you read that book, right away you learn the path to discovery is anything but linear, and that the researchers involved are anything but disinterested. So that's the path we're going down today. And we're gonna talk about two different ways of thinking about this process. One of these is what I call discovery, which is the individual scientist like me or whoever looking after at their piece of the world to be studied and trying to learn something new about the world. And then the second is credibility, because when you learn something about the world, you can't be sure that what you learned is actually correct. So to make it science, you have to turn to other people and tell them what you think is the way things are. So that process is credibility. So discovery. So rather than linear, I already said the path tends to be highly ambiguous and convoluted. Failure is frequent. The pressure to produce is great. And the most important experiments often are unintended. So what do I mean by that? And why is that? Okay. So this all starts out with Plato. We all remember Plato. And Plato in the dialogues has a conversation between Meno and Socrates. And Meno says to Socrates, how are you going to look for something, Socrates, if you don't know what it is? And Socrates says, you know, Meno, I understand what you're saying. If you know what you're looking for and you find it, you haven't discovered anything. And if you don't know what you're looking for, you won't know if you discover it because you don't know what it is. It's Plato's paradox. Plato's paradox says that discovery is impossible. It's either one of them or I didn't notice anything. Where? And Plato had a very convoluted answer. Does anybody know Plato's answer to this paradox? Anybody? No? No, Plato said that when you're born, you forget everything that you knew. But that you knew everything at the moment you were born. And that you spend the rest of all your life remembering what it was that you knew when you were born, and you mistake that for discovery. Plato didn't understand, however, how science works, because he's thinking of discovery as an event, not as a practice or as a process. And if you think it as a process, there's some space in between here for something like, well, it looks like one of them, or I'm not sure, but I don't know what it is, I've never seen one before. So a lot of what turns out to be associated with discovery is noticing stuff that you weren't actually looking for when you started out. Now, noticing is very, very hard, especially noticing something you're not looking for. So I'm going to give you the opportunity to see if you can notice something humorous. That's all I'm going to tell you about what it is. It's humorous. In this diagram of the apparatus that was used by Melvin Calvin to study photosynthesis, work for which he eventually got the Nobel Prize. And there is incorporated, somebody put in this diagram, this apparatus, a humorous element that nobody noticed. We don't know who put it there. Could have been actually that Calvin noticed it, he put it there maybe, or the postdoc on the paper, but the referees didn't notice it, the redactors didn't notice it. It got published in the literature and was there for 10 years before anybody noticed. So it's very hard to notice something that you're not looking for as expected. So before I ask if anybody's noticed what it is, I'm going to point out something about knowledge that's really critical. and that is that right now you are researching an open field, but once I show you what it was that was put in that diagram, you will never be able to look at the diagram without seeing what I showed you.
Of course.
And so that will limit your ability to have new ideas. So anybody notice the unusual circumstance? For how many people? Anybody? No. Two people. Okay, what did you think?
I just see something, a drawing.
A drawing, okay, and you?
Taking LTO2 and your writing skills.
Okay, well, those are good things, but this is the humor song. You see, right here? Blown up right here?
Mm-hmm.
You see this guy?
Yeah, I saw that. Oh,
he's fishing!
Okay. Some of us are artists.
You see the fisherman?
Yeah.
See if you can look at this now without seeing the fisherman. Go ahead, try.
What is fishing?
Yeah, and he actually caught something, right?
Yeah,
he's got a fish on the end of that.
Okay.
And actually, we say it's a fisherman, but maybe it's a fisher girl or lady or whatever. But in any case, the point is that this was out there in the literature for a long time, and it became kind of a sort of a legend. And then everybody's emailing back to just see the fisherman in the apparatus, you know, doing Calvin's photosynthesis machine. So the point is, when you're trying to see something or notice something, if you're not actually looking for it, it's really hard. So there are different ways. So there are two ideas out there about getting to notice something unexpected in practice. One of them is a British mathematician, a philosopher named Michael Polanyi, talked about tacit knowledge. And what he said was, well, you actually know more than you think you know. So discovery could be getting in touch with that knowledge that you know, that you don't know that you know. Right, that's not complicated. And then Max Delbruck, who created modern molecular genetics, he used to talk about limited sloppiness, which he didn't mean by technical sloppiness. He meant by thinking, because you don't know everything when you're designing experiments. It's a little muddy, the British English version of sloppiness. And so when you do your experiments, you do more than you intend. Here's my favorite example of that, just to make clear what I'm talking about. So Anita's a rabbit, years, right? So in the early 1950s, a very famous physician scientist at Sloan Kettering in New York was injecting Pat Pain and other enzymes intravenously into rabbits because they thought that maybe heart valve disease was caused by release of enzymes. And so maybe they could duplicate this process by intravenous injection of a group of enzymes, something you never could do now. And when they injected the enzyme called papain, 4 hours later, the rabbit's ears did that. So that observation became ultimately a publication called Reversible Collapse of Rabbit Ears, okay, and ultimately became the beginning of osteoarthritis research on destruction of cartilage in joints. Because nobody knew that enzymes could play some role in the destruction of cartilage up until this crazy experiment. So what happened, though? What happened in this experiment? So he was studying a puzzle. The intravenous enzymes cause cardiac and blood vessel lesions. And he did an intended experiment. He injected papain. And the papain caused the rabbit ears to flop down. That's unlikely to be related to the problem of cardiac and blood vessel lesions. At that point, he could have just left that. But he noticed that observation in a different context. He said, well, if I was studying the question, does rabbit ear rigidity depend on a papain sensitive mechanism, which he wasn't, that's the unintended experiment, then this would make sense. Yes, it depends on papain. You know, eureka. We've discovered a whole new thing. So there's a total switch. What's here is that what he was studying is up here, but he actually did an unintended experiment, and he noticed the unintended experiment. And it's a kind of a gestalt switch in thinking about what your data means. So that's a major event that occurs, and there's no predicting who's going to notice, who's not going to notice. So what can you do if you want to think about promoting unintended experiments? You use a new instrument, you can work in a new field, you can work with new collaborators, you can read the literature looking for anomalies. The thing is that what you're after with unintended experiments is what you weren't expecting, and the problem is to notice it. So what determines what you notice and what you don't notice? And my favorite language for describing that, it comes from this book by Ludwig Fleck called Genesis and Development of a Scientific Fact. And Fleck introduces the language thought styles. This is a book that predated Thomas Kuhn by 30 or 40 years, who talked about paradigms. And actually, when Kuhn wrote his very famous book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, he talks about how, you know, when he read Fleck, that gave him confidence, actually, in his ideas. So Fleck says, all understanding is contextual. We interpret experience in the framework of our life situation, our personality, education, our experience. And thought styles determine what can be noticed, what you think it's going to mean, and seeing things one way means not seeing them another. So the thought styles are very useful. And just as an example, we all share this thought style. What is this? What is it? Smiley face. Everybody in this room recognizes that as smiley face. What's that?
Bowling
ball. You know, notice all the men say bowling ball, you know? And here any women say bowling ball. So, but you have to know something about bowling or have gone bowling to know that's a bowling ball. So that's less of international than that. Well, what is that? Go ahead.
Target,
soccer ball, diagram, you know. So we all share this thought style. Some of us share this one. This one is harder. So, but language and communication is made possible by shared thought styles. So what happens when you think about, well, what's an experiment? When you do a scientific experiment, so you're answering questions. So what's the best way to go from home to work? This is about where I live. Down here is where I work. What am I going to get from Google Maps? What's it going to tell me? What's its criteria going to be?
Shortest.
Okay? Well, what if, you know, I develop a lot of anxiety? Driver of the Dallas North Tollway. That's not the best way. I need, you know, something like Turtle Creek. I need the outdoors. So there are two answers to this, you know, what's the best way? They're totally different. And yet, there are two answers, and probably they're, you know, equally good depending upon what one has in mind. And so how about, though, when we talk to each other in the laboratory about our experiments, we talk and the ideas pass back and forth from person to person. Well, some of you may have played this game when you were younger.
Yeah.
And that whoever says something to him, that's not what ends up there. Okay? So nothing is left of the original. Whose idea is circulating? And that's another place where we don't know often. You know, well, there's a lot of controversy potentially about whose idea it is. And then you have to decide if you're going to do science, what do you want to study? So you're just going to sort of pick randomly? Well, no. You want to make sure you study something that's not solved, that's worth solving, and that you can do. Because if you don't meet those criteria, then you're going to fail in your career as a scientist. So when you choose to test something, this is not an objective commitment. You don't really have a conflict of interest from the very get-go, as soon as you start studying and choosing a problem because you want to succeed. These are all very scarce resources. And then there's the experimental design. And we were talking about this. I forget who, but we were talking about this earlier tonight. Explicit assumptions determine the question that you think you're asking. But implicit assumptions determine how you're going to measure it. So every experiment that you do actually tests two things. What you're testing and how you're testing it. Both the hypothesis and the method. So the thing is that if you don't get the answer that you're looking for, it could be that the hypothesis is wrong, but it could be that the method is wrong. A lot of people talk about Karl Popper and the idea of falsifiability as the measure of empirical research, because Popper says, well, it's possible for an empirical system to be falsified. Well, it can't be falsified. Because if you say, if I do an experiment and I say, you're wrong, look at the result I got, I say, well, no, I used the wrong method. If I'd used the right method, I would have gotten a different answer. So you can always have that controversy, that ambiguity between what you do and the results you get and the method you use to get. In practice, you can explain away contrary findings. So the commitment of falsifiability is the commitment to be willing to say, hey, I was wrong. If you can't say I was wrong, if no data is going to change your mind, you're not doing science. You're doing something else. And then you have to choose what counts for data. Because it's not so obvious. If you're at the sort of the edge of discovery, you know, data and noise are kind of interchangeable. And it's your thought style, your experience, your intuition that determines. And what counts one day may turn out to be data to turn out noise. So here, it's my very first experiment. First experiment I ever did at UT Southwestern Medical School. Well, not first, but the first one in the line of research I ended up getting involved in. Measuring how tissue cells interact with the extracellular environment. So the work I did was sort of in tissue engineering, as you heard, at Muntion, and I was interested in how cells interacted with it. Here's what I was measuring. Because that was just, this was very simple. The number of cells that were stuck to a dish as a function of time. Because I was trying to figure out, well, what's the mechanism of cell sticking? That was basically the question. And I was trained in entomology, and so an entomologist measured the rates of things happening at that time anyway. So that's what's that. And I took some pictures because I just did, and saved them, which turned out to be a good thing. They're horrible pictures. Okay, so that they're really, that was my word. The quality, I've got some here, thank you. The quality of these pictures is, you can see big pieces of dirt, medium-sized pieces of dirt, little pieces of dirt. The cells aren't in focus. It just doesn't get worse than this.
It was a long time ago, but I could count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
But I was trained as a biochemist, not as, you know, a microscopist or a histologist. I was interested in the number of cells that attached, not their appearance. So between 1971 and 1974, I published 9 papers. There were 44 figures and 28 tables, all cell-sticking quantitative data. Nothing about cell shape. Then I did this experiment in 1975. This was an unintended experiment. And I realized that the cells change shape here, but not here. Now, I don't know, does everybody agree with that? You all see that? Or you're not so convinced? Well, people weren't very convinced. Okay? But I was convinced because my thought style had evolved because I had started teaching histology to medical students, so I was now thinking about cell shape and cell size and cell position and cell color. I thought, oh my God, it's the shape! And a few months later, I could do that. Because I turned this into this because I knew what I was looking for now. I had noticed the shape change, and I could optimize conditions to make it happen. And now it became easy to see that shape change, and I realized that the biological important thing that was happening and what a variety was looking for was the shape change, not the number of cells that attached. And I published this paper, Cell Spreading Factor, and from then on, all the research I was publishing was cell shape, not number. So what started out as data, number, shape was irrelevant, and then eventually shape became critical, and number became pretty much irrelevant. I had that picture. Remember that picture I showed you? So let's go back. Here's that picture, that very first picture. And in retrospect, these cells and these cells are a different shape. Mm-hmm. But here's what I wrote in my notebook. Essentially no processes, completely different pattern. And that was the end of it. So that was 5 years beforehand. I sort of noticed it, but I didn't notice it enough to have any impact on it. And I actually had forgotten all about it until years later when I went back. So I rediscovered the same thing 5 years later, and then I, in a different way, and I was prepared to see it. So just noticing itself, even if you notice, isn't necessarily going to have any consequences. And then another thing can happen in this whole area of data selection and what data can be a controversy about who's seen what. So this is a picture of Robert Millikan, who got the Nobel Prize for discovering the charge of the electron. In his work, he published data showing the result of 58 out of 150 oil drops. We know that because historians who read his notebooks discovered that there were 150 oil drops, and he had only used 58. Now, it might not have been a problem, except he said he used all the data. So then, some people started saying, oh, crap, this guy, this is a really well-known case of cooking, which is falsification, where you change your data to match your hypothesis. But then a few years later, Sigma Xi gave their annual most important prize to David Goodstein, who was the provost at Caltech, and his lecture was in defense of Robert Millikan. And he said that he went back and viewed the experiments, and what he concluded was that Millikan did publish only the experiments that counted, because he defined how data was, what counted for data and what didn't. And so that it wasn't simply that he arbitrarily selected 50 out of 140 drops. There were very good reasons why these were not, the ones that were not part of this group, were not considered. All right, so we're done.
The fact is, that was remarkably accurate. It's still, with modern data, it's still very close.
Yeah, and there's still a debate about how he did it, because some people say he's trying to, yeah, but you're right, and Millikan, you know, was amazing that he got the right number. So we're done talking about discovery. I've discovered something, and now we're going to turn to credibility. I want you to believe that what I've discovered is correct. How does the discovery come to become a discovery? The path to credible knowledge. I start out in my laboratory as an individual researcher. It's my me, here, and now. That's it. It's my existential life. How does that transform into the scientific community's intersubjective anyone, anywhere, anytime? So now that's what we're going to talk about, the ambiguity of that process. Okay, the discovery claim that becomes a credible discovery sometimes becomes a scientific fact. So we have to start out talking about Michelangelo to understand even what we're talking about. And that is, this is his famous painting, or sculpture, St. Matthew. And Michelangelo says about this statue, in every block of marble, I see a statue as plain as though it stood before me. I only have to hew away the rough walls that imprison the lovely apparition. Okay? Now, if Michelangelo had stopped there, then we wouldn't even be talking about him in this talk. But Michelangelo did stop there. He added a few more words. He said, to reveal it to other eyes as mine see it. So now he's making a discovery claim. He's not just talking about a piece of art that he's created. He's saying, you'll see it just like I see it. And that's what discovery claims are. I'm claiming something that's beyond me. I'm claiming something that is objective, if you like,
And I'm inviting you to see if you see it too. He says that. So scientific discovery is like artistic discovery, but you always have to do this. You always have to reveal it to other eyes as you see it, otherwise it's not science. Art can stop, science can't. And here's the problem. This is that famous René Magritte painting, The False Mirror. Magritte's looking out. He's pretending that when you look out, you see a reflection of what's there. But we know that it's not. No matter how hard you try to be objective, you may be deceiving yourselves. All our observations are subjective. So how do we get beyond that? How do we get to objectivity? And the answer is we turn to each other. We turn to other people. We transcend our subjectivity through intersubjectivity. The idea that, well, I'm standing here and I'm looking out at you all, and I see you, but if you were standing here looking out there, you would see the same thing that I'm seeing, or you're seeing me back here. So we have this kind of reciprocity of perspectives that helps us convince each other that we're sharing our experience together. So that's what he's doing here. He's showing these guys, and they're saying, oh, yeah, I see it too. You know, you're right. This is so that's what objectivity is about. And when you publicize discovery claims, make them available to other people, then that invites the possibility of validation and verification. But here's the one of the major problems with that. It's another Magritte painting, which is a great example of the Albert Svengiorgi comment that discovery is seeing what everybody else has seen and thinking what nobody else has thought. So Magritte's looking at this egg and he's painting a bird in full flight. Okay? Well, you know what happens when you see what everybody else has seen and you then think about it and the way nobody else has thought about it? Well, you know what the initial reaction to you is, right? What is it? That's right. So it's a strange situation. The more novel your discoveries are, the more they challenge intersubjectivity, and the more likely you are to have your ideas rejected, whether it's your ideas or your papers or your grants. So these are famous, famous journals, Science, Cell, and Nature, and these are famous discoveries, radioimmunoassay, site-directed mutagenesis, and monoclonal antibodies. They're all rejected by these major papers to where they're and here a bunch of observations in Science called fusion, N-rays, polywater, prions, ribozymes, cumulons, hotter theory. When they were first proposed, they were all rejected. You've got to be nuts. You've got to be kidding. So three of these became Nobel Prizes, and three of these became sources of the history of science and failed science. So you can't tell. And here's a great example. This is a man named Ralph Steinman who studied a kind of cell in the skin called, in a lot of places called dendritic cells. And nobody believed him. And when he won the Nobel Prize in 2011, when he won another prize that often people get before the Nobel, called Lasker, in 2007, Joe Goldstein. So that's Joe Goldstein, who's the Nobel laureate at UT Southwestern Medical School, who's one of our leading scientists there, wrote, why were his studies ignored, neglected, and denigrated? And he goes on to say, the powerful force of dogma made it easy for the community to brush aside his experiments and his ideas. Fortunately, his passionate belief in his data and unshakable self-confidence pushed him forward. So when you do science, especially when you're doing really novel science, you actually have to go out and become an advocate for your discoveries. You have to convince other people that what you've done is right and it's worthwhile for them to believe, and yet you have to be intellectually honest at the same time, which is a real challenge, and there's a lot of ambiguity in what you do in that situation, and you might be wrong. You always might be wrong. You have to remember that as a possibility. So, William James talked about what truth meant in pragmatism, and they said that truth happens to an idea. Something becomes true over time through its use and through how people understand it.
And that's what I say about credibility. And credibility happens to a discovery. The discovery becomes credible by events, verification and validation by others going forward into the future or the opposite. And when you think about it this way, you realize that the idea of objectivity is something that belongs to the community, not to the individual. The individual may try to be objective, but it's the community that, as a group, eventually determines where beliefs are, can be considered objective or not. Okay, so everyday practice of science, choosing to investigate a problem means an investment. These are some of the key ambiguities. Doing the studies and collecting the data doesn't mean that important results will be noticed. What counts for data one day may appear to be noise the next. If your results don't agree with your expectations, it could be that your ideas are wrong or your methods might be wrong, so don't give up a good hypothesis just because the data don't fit. And everybody doesn't believe you, that rejects you. That doesn't mean you're wrong. Success requires commitment and entails risk. Okay. But I still haven't told you why MetaWorld said the why you raised that question about research papers. So to do that, we're going to have to now go into the, spend a few minutes talking about how discovery claims get made. Now those are, these are these three very famous journals in the biosciences. These are the three most important: Science, Nature, and Cell. These are the most prestigious. Research papers or scientific short stories. So the first place, keep in mind, when we do research, there are three types of experiments. The most common is that things don't work. 90% of the things I do in the laboratory don't work. And the secret of success is learning how to overcome those failures and figuring out what to do. Every once in a while, I learn something new. And sometimes it can actually publish something new that I learned, but usually I have to tweak it to make it demonstrative so that it's relevant. So remember, I showed you those two pictures. There was a heuristic picture I showed you of cells that had spread. And I said, well, but no, you might not believe this, but that's what I believe. But then a few months later, I was able to make it really different. That, so I went from heuristic to demonstrative. So what happens? Well, this is what one publishes, a small percentage of what one does. So 10 notebooks in a laboratory could become 10 figures. So we throw out an incredible amount of what we do. Nobody ever knows about it. Nobody ever sees it. And so our judgment that this doesn't count, just like those drops, 150 drops, 50 got published, 100 got thrown away. It's not what, it's just noise, okay? And then not only that, but we always also have a historical reconstruction of what happened. Here's my favorite example of that. So Francois Jacob discovered a messenger RNA, which is the intermediate between DNA and proteins. So this is like a key discovery in molecular biology and understanding how cells make proteins and how genetics is it works. And this is an autobiography. So he writes at one point towards the middle of the book, we were doing very long, arduous experiments, but nothing worked. We had tremendous problems, full of energy and excitement, sure of the correctness of our hypothesis. They did not abandon their hypothesis just because the data didn't fit. We started our experiment over and over again. So they're trying to prove that there's this intermediate. And then he talks about being on the beach towards the end, our confidence crumbled. We found ourselves lying limply, I wish I could write like this, vacantly gazing at the huge waves of the Pacific crashing onto the sand. Only a few days were left, the inevitable end. Should we keep on? Suddenly Sydney, this is a man named Sydney Brenner, gives a shout, yells the line, the magnesium! And we race to the lab to do it one last time. So of course it turned out to be the magnesium. Otherwise, they wouldn't have made the discovery, and if they didn't make the discovery, they would have all gotten Nobel Prizes, and they wouldn't have gotten to write their memoirs. So, you know, but anyway, they go back. So now, here's the paper, okay? An unstable intermediate carrying information from genes to ribosomes for protein synthesis. So how does it start out? Sure of the correctness of our hypothesis, a priori, three types of hypotheses might be considered. So there's no commitment here. This is, you know, the scientific method as good as it gets. We're going to sort of think about this in a sort of general way. And now they get the bulk of the RNA synthesized after infection is found in what's called the ribosome fraction, provided that extraction is carried out in 0.01 molar magnesium ions. Remember, it's the magnesium. They even found a reference to a paper with high magnesium so that they could write this up as if they did it according to the standard method in the literature. And then they go on to say, and then, of course, lowering the magnesium concentration results in the radioactive RNA leaving the B band. The summer of frustration became a control experiment. Okay? So, Jacob understands this all too well. And here's what he writes. Writing a paper is to substitute order for the disorder and agitation that animate life in the laboratory. To replace the real order of events and discoveries by what appears as the logical order, the one that should have been followed if the conclusions were known from the start. It's called the scientific method, ladies and gentlemen. The scientific method is the plot of scientific papers, not the scientific adventure.
Yeah. I think now in schools they are teaching kids that there is a lot of exploration. And then it is kind of a reconstruction in a linear fashion, rather than saying, yeah, you always start with a hypothesis and do these steps in this order and never deviate.
Yeah, and if they actually get kids to read memoirs, then they'll get to hear those stories.
Yeah.
But a lot of times what happens is in programs they read papers. And of course, when they read papers, it makes it sound just like
this. Right.
So this explains one thing, why research notebooks are so important, because all research papers are edited. So what backs up this edited record are these research notebooks, which is the historical record. And then the other thing is that it makes it clear that there are actually three versions of science now. Okay? We have everyday practice, which disappears into research publications, which then disappear further into textbooks, which just pick up the facts and you don't even know the publications where they're coming from. And this process of practice going to publications requires data selection and historical reconstruction. So no wonder Sir Peter Medawar said the scientific paper is a fraud. But that's the way science is done and practiced. And everybody in the community understands them. So if you're looking in from the outside, it might look really weird. But if you're part of the community, you understand that that's the practice of the community. So one other thing, one final ambiguity to leave you with, and that is that in order to get papers published or grants funded, one has to go through what's called the peer review process. So what does that mean? It means that when you submit a manuscript or a grant, experts are going to analyze it and decide if they're okay, if it's okay. Those are the peer reviewers. And if they agree it's okay, then your paper can get published or your grants can get funded out to the community of research and your knowledge becomes public. These peer reviewers actually don't decide if it's okay by trying to repeat what you do. They simply judge if it seems reasonable. Okay, so who are these people who are peer reviewers of your research grants and papers? Well, there are people like you who know a lot about your subject. So think about playing poker, showing your opponents your cards, asking them for their advice, and expecting them to play their cards just as if they never saw yours. That's what peer review is all about. It's incredible. It requires an extraordinary degree of trust. And it's inherently a conflict of interest, but it's one of the things that's made American scientists, science especially, very, very strong. Okay, so just last thing, research integrity and the U.S. National Academies, Science and Engineering. So our academies have done three studies of this question. The first one was published in 1992. The second one in 2002, and the third one in 2017. The first one was all about the definition, okay? We should adopt a common framework of definitions, okay, among misconduct, questionable practices, fabrication, falsification, and plagiarism. We should remove the ambiguous categories. That was really the focus. The second one was trying to find a solution. I actually was part, I'm prejudiced. I participated in this study, and the committee came up with a proposal. Research institutions should evaluate and enhance the integrity of their environments by self-assessment and external peer review in an ongoing process of quality improvement, and we should try to make this part of accreditation wherever possible. That idea was so not liked by the entire community. Everybody didn't like it, and so it never happened. But it was the best idea as far as I'm concerned. And then we have 2017, the most recent study, and basically they've given up. What they said was, we need an advisory board. Okay? That's the key. We're going to solve this by having a research integrity advisory board. Hello. So anyway, that's all I have for you. So if there are questions or comments, that's the end of my comments. Yes.
Questions for Dr.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, on peer review, this is like auditioning for an orchestra. I mean, if you're auditioning for an orchestra, for places in an orchestra, it's live. Like, you need to open your mouth and put to the back. In other words, you're supposed to play whatever they tell you, and so it's blind, unbiased process. Now, for peer review, do the other people, the people reviewing the paper, know whose paper it is, and does the person who's getting his paper reviewed know who's reviewing it? Because it seems to me, if that's possible, that greatly biases the process, and, you know, in terms of people stabbing each other in the back, or, I've got a buddy who's going to publish something like this, so I'll stab this guy.
They're different. I mean, in the sciences, the social sciences are somewhat different. But in the sciences, most papers, when they're reviewed, the reviewer knows who you are. You do not know who the reviewer is. When grants are reviewed, it's slightly different. The reviewers know who you are. You know the composition of the committee of 15 or so scientists that reviewed your grant. You don't know who the individuals were who were the primary reviewers of your grants, but you know who was on the committee, so you can sometimes guess. But in general, it's a one-way process. In general, the person who's submitting a grant or submitting a paper does not know who's commenting on it and deciding whether it's okay or not okay. And so a lot of people feel that it should be double-blind, that the reviewers should know. So there has been some data that's been published in the last couple of years that, for instance, women don't do as well as men. African Americans don't do as well as Caucasians. If you come from Harvard, you're more likely to get your paper accepted than if you come from Oshkosh University. So, you know, it's there is evidence of bias that some people see, but nobody's come up with a better mechanism so far. So that's the current status.
Yeah, I think a double blind thing. From a personal experience, I wrote a short article that was very practical about I don't even remember exactly, but it was a technique, cosmetic dermatology injection or something or other. And it was sent to a journal, and then it was peer-reviewed, and one reviewer did not like it because in one of the pictures, I didn't have gloves on. It had nothing to do with the procedure or its outcome, but I didn't have gloves on, so I rejected the paper. And I didn't know who he was. He knew me, of course.
Right.
But I didn't know who that was.
Finally got you.
He did some personal things. Anyway.
My question would be about the matter of funding.
Yeah.
How does that play in, and how do you account for the different slants or outcomes or agendas of that influence, perhaps, by funding?
Well, when for instance, the National Institutes of Health first started, the funding mechanism focused on what people wanted to do. So that there were a lot of people submitting grants to study diabetes, then they had to have a review group to evaluate diabetes. If there were a lot of people who wanted to study arthritis, then they had to have a review group that could evaluate arthritis. So over time, you know, the community's gotten larger and larger, and the amount of money available is such that about 1 in 5 grants gets funded. So you have two things going on at the same time. You have NIH, you have about 3 things actually. You have Congress that provides a certain amount of money for NIH and sometimes designates certain funds for certain areas that are viewed to have particular health importance. Then you have NIH trying to establish some kind of a strategic plan in order to decide what areas need to be included. And then at the level of each different review group, let's say I go to a review group and we get 60 grants to review. And they're in diverse areas, and we cover all of, let's say, experimental cell biology. And then we have different people in the review group of 10 or 12 or 15 that have different things that interest them a lot. And then of those 60 grants, we're going to cut out the first 30 and say these are, you know, never going to get funded because we know what the funding level is roughly. And then we'll discuss in that group, and one or two or three people will present the work to everybody else. And their job is to present it and critique it, but also to promote it, because what you really want to see is there's a certain competition. You want to see your field advance. You don't want to see your field die out. So there's a kind of pro competition between investigators to promote research, even though it's your competitor who's doing the research. So it's a very complex structure. And in the end, I would say that the biggest weakness is that the grants are reviewed on a continuous scale, but there's a funding cutoff. That's all we're doing. So if you have a grant, let's say, that has a score of 2.5, you might get funded, and the person with a 2.6 won't get anything. But there's no difference in the quality of a 2.5 or a 2.6. So I've always been very critical of that practice of funding on an all or none basis, for reviewing on a linear model. Does that answer your question? Or no?
That was my question.
Yeah.
And what about the difference between public and private funding?
Well, that's a whole different thing. I mean, private funding, people have particular agendas. So in Texas, we have CPRIT, which is effectively private in a sense. I mean, it's funded by you and I, and the people in Texas put money into that, but it only funds cancer research, and then certain kinds of cancer research. In California, they have the Committee for Stem Cells, and or the Center for Stem Cells. They have a large amount of money. Or the Welch Foundation in Houston funds research oriented towards chemistry. Or the American Cancer Society funds research oriented towards cancer. So there's a multiplicity of different funding mechanisms in the United States, and that's, you know, and that's sort of how we end up in a non-systematic way covering the entire, you know, range, except where we're not allowed to do stuff because of political decisions.
Question.
It struck me that some of the first slides you show were the problems in science are taking kind of an exponential increase, although the numbers are pretty small, is synchronous with the attacks that we're getting from all sides questioning the ability of scientists to do science. And I'm wondering, is there a link there? In other words, are we being scrutinized more and perhaps by people who don't have the expertise to scrutinize these sorts of things? And is there a pushback that we can do?
Yeah, that's a good question. We talk about, you know, false news and scientific organizations like that we're going to have an EPA that doesn't look at data. I do not believe that those two things are linked together. I think that the issues with science and its practice have to do with the environment right now that's been created by the pressure to produce in order to keep your position, and the fact that we have what's called soft money in this country, so that most researchers depend to a very large extent on grant support. So you're getting evaluated every 3 years to make sure you've published enough stuff and that your research is going well in order to get your grant renewed. So that means you need to be productive, and if you're not productive, you're going to lose your grants. If you lose your grants, you're going to lose your salary or your job. So that environment is not a healthy environment, personally. And there are some institutions, UT Southwestern is not one of them, I'm happy to say, but there are some institutions where faculty members support themselves 100% off their grants. And so that creates an incredible pressure, and I think people may take shortcuts in order to get by. The political issue, I think, is different. I think that people have very strong feelings about political matters, and those feelings translate over into scientific matters. So there's the folks who tend to be more conservative, who don't, for instance, believe that global warming is caused by humans. In many ways, they are very science smart. It's not their lack of knowledge about science. It's their skepticism about whether or not science can answer this particular question. Just in the same way that we have very strong political feelings about whether or not you can use embryos for doing research in this United States. And a lot of that is connected to views about whether or not one is pro-life or pro-choice in terms of abortion. And those are very strong feelings that have nothing to do with understanding science. That have to do with the fact that people bring their thought styles, their own personal preferences to the work that they do, and their interests and their beliefs, and that influences what they're willing to accept or not accept.
So there's a lot of subjective bias.
That's right.
You've made it pretty clear that there's a lot of ambiguity, necessary ambiguity, but I think with the intent of an honest approach to trying to find out an answer. I mean, there's literally ambiguous things you have to deal with and choices you have to make that are not cut and dried and stuff like that. On the other hand, Monsanto has been caught literally fudging quite a few studies, which could hardly even be called studies, and then citing them as scientific evidence or proof that their GMOs and stuff are good for everybody. Clearly their intent was to justify their business interest. What's your take on that?
Just switched talking from research integrity to conflict of interest. Conflict of interest is one of my favorite subjects. I'm actually the co-chair of UT Southwestern's Conflict of Interest Committee. And conflict of interest is much more dangerous than research integrity. Because when there's money involved, people will do all sorts of inappropriate things. You mentioned Monsanto. Just think about Vioxx. So some of you remember a few years ago there was this fantastic painkiller that could be used for arthritis called Vioxx
that was manufactured by Merck. And Merck knew from its secondary studies that Vioxx was causing heart problems, but did not disclose that. And eventually it came out, and eventually Merck was sued, and I think they settled for $4 billion, but they'd already made $10 billion. So you're exactly correct. I think that, and we see all the time where individuals, so we are very tough. If a physician wants to go out and give a talk sponsored by a drug company, you can't do it. We won't let them do it. If a physician wants to be part of a clinical trial and they have a relationship with a company sponsoring that clinical trial, it's okay as long as they don't get more than $5,000 a year from that company. If they get more than $5,000 a year, we're not going to let them. Unless they have some compelling circumstance, like they're the only ones in the United States who could do this and it's really important to do. So conflict of interest is a whole different, you know, game, because people are influenced and they don't believe that they're going to be influenced. I mean, they honestly believe this won't affect me. And there's no question about it. And I just think that it will, even though they think it won't. And they will make decisions that will not necessarily be the same decisions they would make if they didn't have that conflict. I'm glad you brought that up.
I don't know when that rule was made or who actually made the rule, but that every time you go to a meeting and somebody gives a scientific paper, they're required to just give their, you know, any conflict of interest. When I gave a lecture on ethics of AI and medicine, they asked, you know, do I have any research or whatever, you know, funding conflicts or anything.
Yeah.
Anybody?
All right, I've exhausted you. All right, thank you.